Our next case this morning is number 052340, Christopher Regoza against Donald Hulnick, Warden. Mr. Gooden.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Leonard Goodman. I represent Christopher Regoza on this appeal of his habeas petition. And the issue here is whether the Illinois courts properly and reasonably applied Strickland in evaluating the performance of an attorney in a murder case where the attorney was given by his client's mother a list of 8 alibi witnesses who were at their suburban home with the defendant 35 miles away from the scene of the shooting on the night of the shooting. And then over the next 20 months, the mother makes repeated visits to the attorney's office, begging him to prepare the alibi defense, which he steadfastly refuses. And he is so disinterested in the alibi defense that he doesn't even sit the mother down and say, ask her the most basic facts about the alibi, such as, why were there 8 people in your home on a Wednesday evening when you have school-age kids and you have to get up for work in the morning? Therefore, the attorney had to concede that he did not even know that it was her 40th birthday on the night of this occurrence, and that people had come to her house to wish her a happy birthday. Then, on the eve of trial, the attorney writes the mother a letter saying, alibis never work unless you're on the front page of the New York Times with the Pope. No one will believe your alibi. I've been doing this 20 years. Leave me alone. Then, all of a sudden, at trial, the attorney has a change of heart and decides to put on what could only be called a partial alibi. He calls one witness, who, of course, he had never spoken to, the defendant's teenage girlfriend, but he knew what she was going to say because she had given a statement to the police. So she testifies that on the night of the shooting, I took the train out to Mr. Regoza's suburban home. We ate pizza. We watched movies. There were a number of people in the home, including his brother and sister and his mother and some other people that I didn't know. Then the defense rests. None of the other people in the home are called as witnesses, nor does the attorney ever call the mother's boss, who was an unbiased witness, family law attorney Wendy Morgan, who called the home at 9:15, a half hour before the shooting, and it says that Christopher answered the phone. She had a conversation with him about his adjustment to the suburbs. How is your GED classes going? She was never called as a witness, and her husband, who overheard the call, another unbiased witness, was never called. The Illinois courts looked at this.
Did the lawyer ever talk to them?
The lawyer did speak to Wendy Morgan and her husband, who were involved in the case on another matter because in a motion to suppress. So they had been. In fact, Wendy Morgan was one of the people, along with Maria Regoza, the mother, who was pressuring the attorney to prepare the defense. And in fact, the attorney refers to Wendy's interference in his letter to the mother where he says alibis don't work, and he specifically says, if Wendy thinks she knows how to try this case, let her try the case.
Did the attorney have a role in putting together the timeline?
The timeline, the attorney Branstetter had nothing to do with that. The timeline.
No, I'm sorry. No, this the attorney for whom the mother worked.
What happened with this timeline, as I've set forth in my reply brief, it's sort of a long story, but one of the people that was in the defendant's home that night was a woman named Chloe Gavin, who was the Regoza's landlord. And it came out shortly after this that she was apparently a con artist. And she had contacts with Wendy Morgan's law office. She had been stealing stationery from them. But prior to that, she had actually testified in a divorce case for Wendy, for Miss Morgan. So someone from the government investigated this woman, Chloe Gavin, and asked Wendy Morgan to prepare a timeline, which she did. Then the investigator said, that timeline is inadequate. I need a more detailed one. And Wendy's husband prepared the more detailed one and faxed it to the attorney. So yes, Wendy was involved in the initial timeline, but not the detailed one with all the, I think, 24 different dates of contacts with this woman. And as I set forth in the reply brief, this is clearly a red herring. I mean, none of the alibi witnesses were even asked about this timeline. This was clearly a red herring. The Illinois courts, with very little analysis, said that the attorney had made reasonable strategic decisions protected under Strickland.
Did the Illinois courts ever look at the cumulative effect of not calling the rest of these witnesses? It seems to me what it did is it looked at each one and it said none of them was perfect. You know, Wendy could be impeached for one reason and the mother could be impeached because of the comment that Christopher made to her about, I think somebody's going to suspect me, and the children could be impeached because they were children. And we never looked at the whole picture. What's an alibi going to look like with eight other people in the house, none of whom are called?
I don't believe there was that discussion.
Well, Judge Gettleman mentions that. Judge Gettleman says, gee, you know, witnesses may not be perfect, but the state would have had the burden of showing that six different people were perjuring themselves if, in
That's
fact,
correct.
They'd been called.
And Judge Gettleman was specifically responding to what the Illinois courts made a finding that that the attorney could be excused because he called one witnesses and the other ones were clearly cumulative. And Judge
the
Gettleman,
state judge had not seen it that way. Didn't the state judge in the original trial particularly say, you know, it's just this girlfriend's word, you know, Desiree Moyette's word, and where are the other people?
Certainly.
Yeah.
He said, I don't believe your witness. And the state properly made an argument. Judge, where's all these other people that were in the house?
Right. It's hard to call them cumulative.
And that's what Judge Gettleman says in his opinion, that they weren't cumulative. But then Judge Gettleman goes on to say, well, I can't second guess the Illinois courts. And he to justify what happened, Judge Gettleman comes up with an explanation that the attorney's failure to investigate was due to his belief that the alibi was unconvincing. And Judge Gettleman says, quote, Attorney Brandstetter cannot be deemed incompetent for failing to fully investigate an alibi that Brandstetter, in the exercise of his professional judgment, determined to be less than convincing. Now, the problem with that theory is that if that were true, if the attorney had determined that this alibi was unconvincing, then he wouldn't have called any alibi witnesses. No rational attorney would say, I find this alibi unconvincing, therefore I'm going to call, just to put on a little bit of alibi evidence, I'm going to call one witness. I mean, either you're going to try to establish to the trier of fact that the defendant was 35 miles away in a suburban home, or you're going to present another theory of defense. As this court stated in Davis versus Lambert, where the attorney's theory of the case was self-defense, and this court said that attorney had an obligation to at least speak to all the occurrence witnesses who could perhaps help him and put on his best self-defense case. Here the attorney's theory is alibi. That's the theory that he went to trial with, and he hadn't even spoken to 7 out of 8 of the witnesses who were with the defendant at the time of the offense. If there's no questions, perhaps I'll
save your rebuttal.
Thank you.
And we'll hear now from Mr. Ganser.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Anderson Gansner, and I represent the respondent in this case, Donald Hewitt.
Mr. Ganser, maybe you could begin where your colleague left off. Why would you ever put on a defense with one witness, the girlfriend, when you had, seven others? They didn't have perfect credentials, but they all said they were the same place she was.
Yes, Your Honor. The attorney, Mr. Brandstetter, was able to give, in contradiction to what counsel said, did talk to a majority of these potential alibi witnesses. He spoke 30 times with the petitioner's mother. He met Miss Morgan and her husband, Mr. Adams, in person several times.
Now, Mr. Gansner, what's wrong with mothers? I have to say, it's the evening. People tend to be at home if they're minding their business, and especially if they're Mr. Ragosa's age, and juries are quite capable of deciding whether, you know, somebody's mother out of affection or whatever is going to say he was there at my birthday party or not. But these people had phone records, and some per se rule against using family members or mothers seems like a rule that's going to exclude a lot of relevant evidence.
Certainly that's correct, Your Honor, and I don't believe that trial counsel necessarily thought that way. The main reason he...
So what's so thorough about his examination when he doesn't, in fact, talk to... I mean, we call them children, but they were actually early teens, the people there, and the state itself proved a big chunk of its case with a person of that age.
Oh, Raul Quezada, yeah.
Exactly. Yes, so, you know, it just seems to me astonishing that... You know, as anyone who's prosecuted, you yourself, I'm sure, know, the state's probably used plenty of witnesses who were subject to various kinds of impeachment, various kinds of other statements. You got to go with who you have. And if those were the people who were at the home, you have to go with them.
Your Honor, in regards to just finish discussing the petitioner's mother, counsel gave a particular reason in addition to the fact that she was his mother. It was that at a previous hearing on his motion to suppress petitioner's confession, the mother had explicitly testified that the day after the murder, her son had called her less than 24 hours after the murder had occurred and said that he might be blamed for a shooting
right.
in their
and
old neighborhood.
Right, and so that gives him an opportunity. Why did you think that? Because I look a lot like so-and-so. You know, I look a lot like this other person, even though, you know, we have the phone record that I was with my mother all evening. I called my girlfriend from her office. You know, this is not necessarily, again, it goes to the point that this was not a perfect situation, but seldom are situations perfect.
Your Honor, that's correct. And I believe your comments go a little bit more to the prejudice prong of Strickland. And under the performance prong, what we need to look at...
I think they go to both, actually, but...
Regardless, Your Honor, the trial court explicitly found that fact, that petitioner had called his mother less than 24 hours after the shooting occurred, was a very incriminating fact. It repeats
but
that three separate
back
times.
Up, though. You put the girlfriend on, and the girlfriend says, I was at the mother's house all evening eating pizza and watching TV. And you don't even put the mother on to say, yes, Desiree was there?
Yes, that
and,
is what
and
happened.
And so was...
And that's because... of the collateral, the collateral bad fact, which calling the mother would have led to, the very incriminating statement made by petitioner to his mother that less than 24 hours.
It's either incriminating or exonerating, because the truth is, what if this is the wrong guy? What if he was up there in Highland Park? Does that ever strike anyone as a
problem? Your Honor, the only alternative theory that was presented by petitioner's counsel was that the actual murder was a rival gang member, a man referred to as Lucky, according to some of the testimony, Your Honor. However, several eyewitnesses to the crime recalled petitioner having a blonde ponytail, and the evidence is uncontradicted that this other person had a black ponytail. In addition, petitioner had interactions with this other suspect throughout the entirety of the time, from he was arrested to his defense. He was visiting, apparently, petitioner at jail, and petitioner never breathed a word of this to his trial counsel the entire lead up to the trial. Neither did petitioner's co-defendant mention that.
I think that's sort of off the point, though. If you're going to put on an alibi defense at all, why don't you put on the people who can support it?
Your Honor,
Why do you put on one instead of this sort of pick off A, pick off B, pick off C, and you keep saying, you know, we're not going to put the children on because there are adult witnesses, plural, available, and we're not going to put so-and-so on because there's somebody else available, and you never put them on.
Your Honor, what we need, I understand where you're coming from, Your Honor, but here trial counsel was very specific. He had a main attack of defense to attempt to impeach the state's witnesses. He viewed the alibi witnesses as an additional part of that. He only wanted to call an alibi witness if it would go unimpeached, if it would be as unbiased as possible. He viewed
that is to say a bad alibi is a slow plea of guilty.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's what he in his letter to petitioner's mother, he says, any impeachment to an alibi is often fatal to a defense, and I do not want to put on alibis who are usually impeachable. So that is why, after doing investigation, after speaking with the mother 30 times, after hearing this account of how he called her less than 24 hours after the murder occurred and had said that he might be blamed for it, and specifically said, I can't say who might be blaming me for that, a statement which the trial judge found to be very incriminating. He decided he could not call the mother. He also ruled out Miss Morgan, the mother's employer, and her husband quite reasonably.
What about the children? If they were good enough for the state, what about them?
Yes, Your Honor. He gave three particular reasons why he opted not to personally interview the children. He said that first it was because of their ages. He did not want to put on child witnesses if he could avoid
it. How old were they?
I believe at the time of the murder, Your Honor, at the oldest, they were 13, 12, and 11, and the youngest was in fifth grade at the time.
And you remember Hardaway against Young, how the state is more than happy at least to have those people interrogated by the police without any adult nearby.
Yes, Your Honor. And I also call the standards of Hardaway.
I'm just saying, the state's perfectly happy to rely on their maturity when it suits it.
Yes, Your Honor, but that is the prosecution, and here we have a defense counsel who wants to put on the best alibi witness possible. He does not want to seem desperate. The final reason that trial counsel also decided not to personally interview the children was because he was aware that petitioner's younger brother had been expelled from school that day, and he did not want to subject that young man to impeachment on that issue. He testified to that.
Why is that impeaching anyway? I mean, you know, if the children are there with him eating pizza, why aren't they the obvious people to say, I was with him?
That definitely was something he considered, Your Honor, but there were a group of people. They were all at the house. They all would have testified similarly that they'd seen petitioner there.
Right, and he excludes them all, so they don't get anybody. Except
actually, Your Honor, that's not correct. He did call the girlfriend. The girlfriend was I think, quite credible. In comparison to other witnesses, one of the most credible witnesses available. She stated at trial that she had had absolutely no connection with petitioner since his arrest. She stated that she had not talked to petitioner's mother or brother or sister in preparation for trial, and in fact she was separated from direct involvement in preparations by her own attorney who was being negotiated with by petitioner's own trial counsel. She also stated that she was with petitioner the entire evening, that he never left her company. So in comparison to the other alibi witnesses who said they briefly saw petitioner for a moment at the house, her testimony is more
right.
Thorough.
And then the state stands up and impeaches her by saying, oh, she said all this. Where are all these other people?
That's true, Your Honor. They did make that argument. But Your Honor, what
damned
we...
Damned if you do, damned if you don't, huh?
That's correct, Your Honor. There have been cases in the past, for example, in Brewer v. Aiken, Your Honors, where a... client has pressured his counsel to put on an alibi witness, which was easily impeached, and he is attempting to argue at a later basis that it was ineffective assistance of counsel to put on the witnesses that I demanded because they were easily impeached and they made our case look bad. And that is potentially something that might very well have happened in this case if counsel had put on all these additional alibi witnesses, because they would have led to the admission the day after the murder that...
Except that with all the impeachment, what Judge Gettleman points out is they all were at the party or can place him at the house. I mean, there is a commonality in their testimony.
That's
well.
Correct, Your Honor.
And so the state would have had to go through the process of finding all this different impeachment for everybody.
And, Your Honor, it's quite clear since the post-trial hearing was only several short months after trial in the answers to discovery, the state is aware of this. They mentioned specifically Investigator O'Connor, who would have introduced the alibi script or timeline, as this court referred to. So the state is aware of that, and trial counsel was aware of that at the time, Your Honors.
The attorney ever suggest... that he thought there was a conspiracy among the witnesses to cover up?
I don't believe he did, Your Honor. He did not express that specifically. If this court has no further questions, we would ask that it affirm the judgment of the district court denying habeas relief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kanzner. Mr. Goodman has 2 minutes.
I would like to address the... opinion of this court in Washington versus Smith, which I submit is right on point. In that case, the client gave the attorney a list of 6 alibi witnesses, and the attorney called one. As here, the hearing was held in the state court, and the attorney testified that he had an excuse. He got the list too late, didn't have time to interview all these witnesses. The state court said that those are explanations were reasonable under Strickland, and this court disagreed, and this court said that an adequate investigation is surely a right, and that those uncalled witnesses would not have been cumulative, that they would have added a great deal of substance and credibility to the alibi, and that there was a negative inference against the defendant based on their absence, as there was here. And I would submit that in this case, Mr. Brandstetter's explanation for not calling and interviewing the witnesses is far weaker than the attorney for Mr. Washington. Mr. Washington at least had an excuse that he got the list too late. Mr. Brandstetter got the list 20 months before trial. His explanations were based on broad generalizations about children and family members, and also on misinformation. His belief that the state had impeachment on Wendy. If you read Wendy Morgan's testimony, you'll be amazed at how strong her testimony is and how weak the impeachment was. He was dead wrong on that. He was dead wrong that there was impeachment on Noemi Cordova. The attorney said that I thought that there was a report where she said something, and when I showed him the report, he said, well, okay, it's not in there. So this attorney's excuses were not sound.
Do you think those are the two strongest additional witnesses, Wendy and Noemi?
I certainly would have called the mother as well, Your Honor.
Despite the comment that he made, which would have come out.
Well, I don't believe that comment was incriminating. And without the mother, you couldn't have gotten in the telephone call from her law office. And if the comment to his mother was incriminating, the state could have called the mother and put it in as a statement against interest.
Oh, come on. State call his mother?
Certainly, if the statement attributed to the defendant was really an incriminating statement.
It was an incriminating statement. It had to be explained. How did he know he was going to be charged with a crime?
I don't believe it is. I believe it's an exonerating statement because it shows how he got misidentified. But if it wasn't, for example, if the defendant had said to his mother on the phone the day after the crime, I did something last night I shouldn't have done.
No.
And that came out in a pretrial hearing. The state could have called the mother and put that statement in if it were incriminating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Indeed, our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.